I do think that a big part of leadership today is not just getting people to do what you want them to do. A big part of leadership today is changing minds, changing heart sets, changing mindset.
Exude Human Capital hosts, hold on, let me close my door, bringing real HR stories from real professionals with real solutions to you. Join us as we navigate the ever-changing workplace with Allison DeFlorio, co-founder and managing partner, Exude Human Capital, and special guests. Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to today's podcast of Hold On, Let Me Close My Door, stories from real professionals doing the kind of work that we at Exude Human Capital feel is really important to our listeners. For those of you that are joining us for the first time, welcome. For those of you that have listened before, welcome back. I'm Allison DeFlorio, co-founder and managing partner of Exude Human Capital. And I'm so thrilled today to have a return podcast guest, Chisa Miller, to join us for a conversation, another conversation around the state of diversity in our world today. Welcome, Chisa.
Hi, happy to be back.
So happy to be back. Chisa, you and I spoke a little bit about today's conversation, but I just want to share for our listeners where this came from and kind of how we got to this conversation. You and I have had conversations around diversity and how the external conversation and factors have impacted people's comfort level or the way people talk about diversity in the workplace. Over the last couple of months, there have been a number of issues, including, that have resulted in some very harsh words and some actions taken around diversity that I think is worthy of a conversation. So toward the end of last year, there were some comments made by a board member regarding the resignation of the president of Harvard University, Dr. Gay. And the comment was, well, something to the effect, this is not a quote, but something to the effect of, well, she was a diversity hire. And when I hear that, and when I hear some of the actions being taken across our country, you know, removing the word diversity from curriculum, removing any training around diversity from curriculum, it just gives me pause. And I think it's worthy of a conversation to get some perspectives from someone like you who works in this space and who's talking about these issues on a regular basis for your perspective. So before we get started, Chisa, for those of you for those of our listeners who haven't met you before, can you take a moment and share a little bit about you, your background, and the work that you do?
Yes. So again, Chisa Miller, I have been in the DEI space for almost 20 years now. Prior to that, I was in the corporate world, in gaming, in Vegas. Originally a Jersey girl. And I don't know what it was about diversity specifically. I suspect in my career as a Black female, I was very young entering the gaming world. I had my own kind of diversity challenges and I just really made a decision to make DEI my passion in my personal life. But then when I had an opportunity to make it my career and the work that I do, I jumped on it and been doing it ever since. So still loving it, always changing. I will say, you know, 20 years ago when I started this work, there was only one word and it was diversity, right? Like there wasn't diversity, inclusion, equity, belonging. Like we weren't talking about all of that back then. It was just diversity. And as you were explaining, I thought about the fact that the word diversity, however you want to pronounce it, was just as much of a hot button term 20 years ago as it kind of is now. maybe in different ways, but you know, I remember going to my first diversity class and thinking, are you kidding me? Like, I don't need to go to a diversity class. I'm a Black girl. Like, go send those other people. It's kind of where my head was at back then, you know, as a in my early 20s. But the I think the stereotype that comes along with just the word diversity in and of itself, right? Like how we define it, how every individual defines it is so different. And I think over the years, particularly as of late, it has become a word that seems to be more divisive than anything else, right? So, I mean, should it be divisive? No. Should it be used as a weapon or anything? Absolutely not. But, you know, I guess that's just kind of where we are. I mean, I'm at the point where I get text messages every day of screenshots from all the different news outlets about, you know, diversity in the news. And everybody's like, hey, are you afraid about, you know, losing your job or, you know, all of these things. So we're certainly in an interesting space when it comes to DEI, but I'm actually loving it. I don't love the fact that we're in this space, but I love the fact that it's almost challenging all of us to engage in conversation. And I think that puts us at a better place today than we probably were 20 years ago, because we were not as open to the conversations.
I think that's a great way to frame it. And it's also interesting to hear you say that, you know, from your recollection, 20 years ago, the word had a similar impact. It's just, and so really what has changed in 20 years? You know, I read recently that many of the major financial institutions who were all about ESG investing over the last several years have officially removed the word diversity from their annual reports, which is just kind of, it just kind of speaks to where we are right now. What is happening in corporate America with this word diversity? What's happening?
Well, I think the short answer is media and politics. That would be my short answer, because you know, no matter who you are, you know, people, even myself, sometimes I have to disconnect because it's just so much chaos. But even when we disconnect, you almost can't escape what's happening in politics and what's happening in the news and social media and all those things, right? So so even if you want to escape it, it's still there. Now, here's how I define diversity as the demographic mix. So in a perfect world, I would love to say that we have moved beyond diversity. 20 years ago, when you looked at the demographic mix in many of these organizations, the demographic mix wasn't very diverse. However, you know, 20 years later, just from statistical facts of immigration and all of these things, we know that in a lot of cases, the demographic mix within organizations looks significantly different today than it did 20 years ago. Maybe not as diverse as we would like, but we are certainly making progress. However we got there, we're definitely making progress, and we're talking about the numbers, right? So I, you know, for me, when we talk about diversity, equity, inclusion, belonging, I would love to be able to say most organizations have gone beyond diversity. But the reality is, we know that there are still companies who have not gone beyond diversity, particularly in their C-suites and, you know, higher levels like that. So, again, I think we turn on the news and diversity becomes this thing that's vilified, when at its simplest form, it is defined by the demographic mix. And I mean, that's what we're talking about. So are we really attacking diversity? No, I don't think we're attacking diversity. I think what is being attacked is this movement, if you will, of, I like to say, it's kind of like a movement of voices, right? Whether it's your Black folks who are speaking up, it's your LGBTQ folks, you know, who are speaking up. It's people who have felt like they haven't had a voice who are now speaking up. And that's creating tension. And here's the like real honest truth. It's creating tension in a lot of spaces, even between groups who both have felt marginalized and both have felt like they don't have a voice. It's creating tension there too, right? We are just a hot mess right now.
That's exactly the phrase I was thinking in my head when you said that. We are a hot mess. And when I think about that, I mean, certainly given where we are as country this year, the social dialogue, the negative social conversation is going to continue, if not ramp up this year. When I think about this from a human resources perspective or business perspective, how can these kinds of comments and rhetoric potentially impact individuals in a workplace, whether that be employees in a workplace from any group, any marginalized group, or candidates who may be thinking about applying or going to work for a particular organization that, let's just say, has removed the word diversity? And again, it's not necessarily the word diversity, but I've had a number of organizations tell me they've actually removed that word from their website as well. So what are your thoughts on how that could actually impact that sense of, do I belong here in an organization?
Yeah. I mean, sometimes there are decisions that organizations make that make sense, and maybe it's good for business. Like, I wouldn't be opposed to the organization who said, I took diversity out of the word out of whatever, because of the negative connotation that comes with it. However, we are still committed to creating inclusive environments and things of that nature. I think that, listen, depending on where you are in this country or maybe even across the globe, it might be smart business to do so, right? So I'm not, opposed to that, but what we do know is that there are organizations who are saying, you know what, forget diversity training, forget inclusion. We're just going to go back to doing what we always did because this is too hard. And that is where I think we have a bigger challenge, right? Like, the organizations who are just like, I'm confused, it's too sticky, it's too messy, and we just don't want any parts of it. And so on both sides, you have qualified, candidates who are coming in who, there's not a person anywhere that doesn't want to work for an inclusive environment or work in an inclusive environment, right? But I think we have to be very careful because we're so much more aware now, the diversity hire, right? Like, any candidate coming into an organization is wondering, even as a minority, I'm wondering, am I getting the job because I'm qualified, or am I getting the job because I fit a quota, right? And if I were the white cis male, I'd be asking the same thing. Am I not gonna get this position because of what I see in the mirror, right? So I just think we're in this space of trying to figure out what do we have to do and how do we do it the right way. From an organizational perspective, how do we do this the right way? How do we coach? How do we mentor? How do we remove barriers for folks who have historically and traditionally had barriers in their way in the workplace? And I think that's why it's so messy right now. Because when we're in a messy space, it just simply means we don't have answers. It's not black and white. And as long as there's no black and white, we're just going to tear each other down until we can try to figure it out.
Isn't it something? It really is. And, it's interesting, and I appreciate kind of your comments about saying, look, for some companies, perhaps it's a business decision and it might be the right decision for them. But I wonder what your thoughts are on what companies can do when they have external stakeholders' voices that are commenting, attacking, or making it challenging for them to move forward with internal initiatives or work or training or mentoring that will address the issues that you described, removing some of these barriers. What advice do you have? How do you have that conversation?
It is an extremely hard conversation to have. And I think for business owners, corporations, not only do they have the stakeholders who are, barking, but they also have employees now that are more savvy than ever before that are like, you need to take a stand. And if you don't, we're out, you know? So I think businesses are in a unique position today, you know, something more unique than maybe we saw 15, 20 years ago. And I think what that is going to require more and more as time goes on is these business owners and these CEOs making a firm stand, which is a really hard thing to do because there are going to be consequences, right? Was it Budweiser? I mean, there's just so many examples of companies who made decisions. They stood firm in them, but there are consequences. And sometimes the consequences are people lose their jobs. People are voted out. I mean, you know, but, you know, something that I often talk about when I do my classes is at the end of the day, I think all of us as parents, as siblings, as children, all the hats that we wear, we're all going to be confronted with those moments of truth and choice, if you will, right? Like, what do I choose to do right now? What are the consequences and can I live with them? And I think that's why we're starting to see so much from the Elon Musks and the Bezos and all these powerful people who have to make a stand. And you know what? Sometimes they're going to make the stand that I like and sometimes they won't, you know? But once they make their decision, now I can make an informed decision on how I choose to spend my money, where I choose to work, and things of that nature, right? So, the only part that I caution folks with that is that is not an easy place to be as that CEO or as that person who has to make a stand. That's not an easy position to be in. And a lot of, you know, many of us, we're not, you know, always confronted with those major decisions, right? George Floyd happened and I got so many calls from CEOs like, I don't know what to do. If I say this, here's what's going to happen. And if I say this, here's what's going to happen. You know, I mean, it's a hard place to be. But I think that's where we're heading. We're heading in that direction. It leadership is taking on like the next level of courage right now. And leaders are really being challenged to make some tough decisions and live with those consequences, whether they be good consequences or not so good.
Yeah, and I appreciate that. I mean, you're right. There are so many stakeholders, and each of those sets of stakeholders, internal, external, are going to have different responses or reactions to any action that a business leader can take. And I agree with you. I believe that business leaders are entering a time and place that is very even more uncertain and uncomfortable than perhaps they've had in the past. So from that perspective, and I know you've worked with many, many business leaders and of organizations in all sectors, what advice do you have for the business leader today who's forced to make that decision? What advice do you have for them?
I think my advice, again, not easy, but we have to make a decision and we have to stick with that decision, right? Be bold with it, be courageous with it, be prepared to defend your reason for it and how it ties into the business case, how it ties into even your own personal values. Because I do think that a big part of leadership today is not just getting people to do what you want them to do. A big part of leadership today is changing minds, changing heart set, changing mindset. And so when you make your decision, I mean, this should be a decision that you make based on your own heart set and your own mindset, and you should be able to defend that. There's extreme potential in getting people to shift their mindset if, you know, we have the courage and the confidence to take a stand and stick with that, right? So again, it's not easy, but I do think some of the most successful leaders, I mean, even throughout history, I mean, we can rattle off names of great leaders throughout history. Why were they so great? Because they stood like a stake in the ground and said, you know, no matter which way the wind blows today, here is where I stand and I will do no other, right? So I think that is kind of where we have been missing it, you know, and this in-between time, we've been able to engage in the conversation, but not get too deep. And we haven't really had to check our own values and our own belief systems, but you can't escape it now. I mean, with diversity being like top five topics on the news today, we should all be asking ourselves, you know, what are some of these belief systems that I hold? And, you know, how is it affecting my business? How is it affecting my family? How is it affecting, you know, everything it is that we do? And, you know, the reality is I can sit here and say what my belief systems are, and, you know, yours could be complete opposite of mine. And that's where the conflict comes in, right? But again, I mean, we just have to, I always tell people this, all human behavior is purposeful, right? Like, there is a reason why I believe the things that I believe in. There's a reason why you believe the things that you believe in. And so we just have to stand firm in those things. But I would also encourage leaders to be willing to engage in conversation, seek to understand, have a hunger to learn. I think one thing that I've learned over the years with particularly, you know, executive leaders, I've worked with some really, really great ones who are on a constant quest of learning and curiosity. And then I have worked with other ones who are just like, I have risen, I am there, I don't need any more growth and development. And those are the scary ones, I feel, you know, those are the scary ones when we get so locked into our own way that we're unwilling to see it from other perspectives. So we can stand like a stake in the ground. That would be the challenge, right? But also be willing to learn and grow. And we all have areas where we need to learn, unlearn, and relearn. And I think the greatest leaders are willing to do that, to self-diagnose, to give themselves the gut check. But stand like a strong leader and firm in their beliefs.
I think everything you've just said, every leader would benefit from hearing. And I also think that, you know, it made me think about once a leader takes a stand, shares a point of view, shares a direction, there has to be some sort of communication back to the organ, back to all the stakeholders, but certainly from an internal, from a talent perspective, employees are going to have questions. And it doesn't mean that the individual has to answer every single question. But what are your thoughts on having an effective communication strategy that shares back when a decision is made, the why behind why the decision was made? Not saying that everybody needs to know every single why behind why a decision is made, but when these are decisions around an issue that impacts inclusion, equity, belongingness, how important do you feel it is that there be a communication strategy back explaining what they can explain about the decision?
I think it's huge. I think it ties into courage as well. I think there's a lot of companies who don't want to be that transparent for fear that of how that those things will be perceived, right? But I think transparency, I mean, oh my gosh, if you want to earn respect and trust and confidence from your folks, that transparency is huge. I mean, on a one-on-one level, from a supervisor to their frontline employee, transparency is just as important as it is from an organizational perspective to the front line. Even if the numbers are like horrible, what you want to show is the work, the dedication, the commitment you're putting into it, and the growth that is happening, even if it's incremental, right? And a lot of times it's going to be incremental. I mean, when we're talking about what we're talking about, diversity and numbers and inclusion and all of these things, it is going to be potentially a pretty slow grind, you know, but that transparency is huge because it tells folks, okay, they don't have anything to hide, because the moment they're not seeing things, they're assuming that things are being hidden, right? So just put it out there. And I'm sure I've probably said this before, I say it all the time. When you are that transparent, there's going to be people who call you out on stuff, right? I mean, and I think as an organization, we have to be prepared for that, right? First of all, there's probably nothing that anybody will call you out on that you don't already know, from an organizational perspective, right? Mm-hmm. So you can be prepared to come back on that. You know, that's on our list. We're targeting it. Here's what our plan is, you know? And then you get to report back and say, here's what we did. It worked wonderfully, or here's what we did and it failed miserably. But here's what we're doing to regroup and continue to move forward. You know, as an employee, what I want to see is that the company cares. The company's making an effort. That's what I want to see. I don't need to see perfection. I don't need to see like this crazy, you know, growth. I just want to see that there is some commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion. And to me, transparency is the absolute best way to show that.
There's a lot of data that supports also that transparency, the degree to which employees of an organization feel that leadership is transparent with them. Again, transparency in quotes, how transparent they can be, is directly impacts how much trust they have in leadership in an organization. And I can imagine, as you said, it takes a lot of courage because when you go out there and you're going to stick by your view and your values and be willing to be transparent, whether the decision proved successful or created some issues, leaders really benefit from taking that step and having the courage to be as transparent as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier conflict, right? Conflict in the workplace, it creates conflict in the workplace just in how people communicate with one another. And I have read quite a bit about the importance of training, particularly managers and above, on conflict resolution, particularly going into the year that we're going into. Interestingly, I have also heard from our own market that using the word conflict training can be almost as off-putting as using the word diversity. So I'd be curious, since you do a lot of training in this space, to hear how you're framing it and what organizations should be thinking about to prepare not just the leaders of the organizations, but the managers, the future leaders of the organization, to have rich conversations this year.
Yeah. I often frame it as like courageous conversations, things, you know, something along that, you know, because the conversations aren't always, I do try to steer away from conflict, right? Because while it just becomes one of those hot button terms again, right? Like, and you almost go into a conversation if you think it's going to be about conflict with your guard up, right? Mm-hmm. So I think courage, and I'm probably a little biased because I work a lot with cops. So courage, like one of those words that we use a lot, right? But to me, courage is almost like a challenge to leaders today, right? To be better, to be stronger, to be more powerful. And to have the courage to engage in conversations that might even test our own belief systems, right? I mean, that's I'll give you just examples of clients that are dealing with, you know, what's happening in the Middle East, and they have Jewish employees and they have Palestinian employees who are working in the same office, who aren't coming to work because both sides are afraid of what they're going to experience or what conflict they may run into in the office. There's just so many things going on right now, but I think the key for those in leadership positions, right? Supervisors, managers, above. One, we have to be prepared for these conversations. You have to be prepared for one or both of these employees to come into your office and say, here's what's happening. Here's where I'm at. They're pissed. They're sad, whatever they're feeling, right? But then how do we create some level of understanding, or, you know, what are the guidelines for what's appropriate in this office, right? How can we still come to work and work effectively with one another, right? And I think that needs to be the goal. How do we engage in that conversation? Maybe it's not talk about specifically what's happening in the Middle East and rehash the history and all that. We may not want to go there, right? And most managers will tell you, I can't go there. Like, I'm not right. even educated enough to know the details. Like, you know, I can't go there. And that's fine. But, you know, are we creating an environment at work, in the workplace, where people can show up and feel like they're safe? And, you know, ideally, they can come to work and feel like they're not being judged by their counterparts, right? And I can still come to work and do my best work. Because if your people can't come to work and do their best work, there's no point in them coming, right? And if they're coming to work and can't do their best work, there's something in the culture of that office or the culture of your team that's probably preventing them from being able to do so, right? So there's a lot of different ways to handle it. I mean, it probably is going to take some one-on-one with the manager and you, and the manager probably wants to loop HR in and just get some, you know, feedback and ideas, you know, some guidance from HR. But I really do think at the end of the day, in the clients that I've worked with through some of these challenges, a leader's willingness to listen and to diagnose where somebody else is, right? We often call that empathy. You know, I mean, I'm not Jewish, I'm not Palestinian, but, you know, I can empathize with both sides, right? And so I think there are some basic skills that all supervisors and above should absolutely have, and organizations should create space to ensure that they have some of those tools. Like, how can we be more effective listeners as leaders? How can we, you know, operate with empathy? I think today, supervisors and above, a lot of their time at work is dealing with these kinds of issues. It's not dealing with the budgets and, you know, that's a part of it. But man, when they're at work, they're dealing with the pain, the hurt, the drama, all the stuff that's going on outside. So I think from an organizational perspective, there is a responsibility to provide the tools and resources to your folks, right? And that is, how can we be better listeners? You know, all of those things. And let's be honest, some of us have supervisors, managers, and leaders in positions who aren't the greatest leaders or who aren't the greatest empathizers and things of that nature, right? Which is okay, but you better have somebody on that team who can empathize really well and who can listen really well, or you're going to create discord on the team, right? So it's a process. I had a really great conversation with a gentleman who was an executive, high executive, and we were doing a class about, it wasn't about feelings, but his interpretation was that all we were doing was talking about feelings, right? And so he was a little aggressive, and he's like, "Is that all we're going to do? Is that all we're going to talk about is feelings?" He was like, "I don't want an employee that's going to come in with a whole bunch of feelings. I want an employee on my team who's got skills, who can get the job done." And I'm like, you know what? I want that too. Like, when I was in gaming, I want a dealer that can deal their behind off, right? And how great is it if I don't have to do a whole lot of training? However, here's the problem. Too many leaders want somebody who has a whole lot of great skill, which is great. But let me tell you what I can teach you. I can teach you how to deal a game. I can teach you how to empty a machine. I can teach you how to cook. I can teach you the skill. What I cannot teach you is to have a great attitude. Give me somebody with a great attitude, I'll teach them the skill. And yes, it may take a little bit more time and all of these things, right? So part of the challenge is, do we have the right people on the right seats of the bus, right? I mean, do we have leaders throughout the organization who have good attitudes, you know, who are willing to listen, who are willing to empathize? Or have we put people into those positions who care solely about the skill and getting the job done? Because great, the job will get done, but, you know, what are the casualties that are a consequence of the job getting done when it lacks empathy and understanding and listening and those, you know, soft skills, if you will? And by the way, everything I just said is diversity. It's diversity training. It's inclusion. It's, you know, and I think people think when we hear diversity, we're like, oh, it's the touchy-feely. Like, no, diversity and inclusion is about, how do we get the job done? But how do we get it done effectively without leaving people in shreds and pieces and burned up in the fire behind us. Like, let's achieve the win, but whole and as a whole team, you know? So that's what it's about. I just think the labels or the stereotype that gets slapped on that word diversity has just really taken it down a whole nother road.
I can't agree with you more, and I appreciate the kind of just the basic human needs that you stated. People want to feel safe. People want to not be judged, so they can show up and do their very best work. And that kind of, if employers are to think about those simple things, and then think about how they can create the environment that allows people to feel safe and where they can respond to people without judging them so people can show up and do the work, we might be in a slightly different place. But the empathy piece is easier said than done. I know you and I have had conversations about this. Sometimes people say, but I do empathize. But I think what we have learned is empathy has to be external. You can think it, but you have to state it. People don't, what is the phrase? People don't care what you know until they know that you know that you care. And sometimes that statement of empathy doesn't come as readily to managers who don't like the touchy-feely thing, the feelings piece that you mentioned.
Exactly. I think empathy looks a little different for different people, but I love Brené Brown. And, you know, Brené has some really just awesome ways of putting things. And she said a lot of times when it comes to empathy, people try to silver lining it. And she said, you know, she used a couple of good examples. Like, for example, I have struggled in my past with having children, right? I had 7 miscarriages. And so people would say to me, well, at least, you know, you could still get pregnant. That isn't necessarily empathy. Now, I know that their intentions were good. It was probably an uncomfortable situation. They've never been through it before. And so it's just kind of what you say, right? But it's okay just to say, oh my goodness, I can't imagine what it feels like to be where you're at right now. You know, even for these CEOs, when Floyd happened or when all of these things are happening, Harvard and all these things, they feel like they have to have something to say. To me, it ties in with the transparency. It is okay to say, I have no words right now. Like, if that's how you're feeling, I don't even know what to say. I need some time to gather my thoughts. I mean, you're human, like you're a human being. So I think in everyday life, we have countless opportunities to practice empathy, but we're just moving so fast that we don't think about what's coming out of our mouth, you know? So, I mean, that's right there is like a good challenge. Like, could we just practice owning the fact that maybe we haven't experienced something? Maybe we have no idea what it's like to be in somebody else's shoes. However, you know, you've had your miscarriages. Hey, I've never, you know, experienced that. But if you need to talk to somebody or if you just need somebody to listen, I'm here if you need me. Right. It doesn't have to be as difficult as a lot of times I think we make it. Right. So, you know, it is an art. I think it's an art. Right. Empathy is something that we can practice and that it's a skill that we have to, you know, practice. And I just think it's one we don't practice enough. You know, it's too touchy feely. And then we have all of the deliverable stuff that becomes the priority, and the empathy and all the understanding and all of those things kind of come secondary, which is unfortunate. I think, however, with the younger generation, I always go back to the future generations. I definitely think they are, I'm hopeful, you know, I'm hopeful because anytime I get a young group coming into my classes, they're just like, people really are struggling with this stuff still. And I'm like, yeah, they are. You know, our young folks are meditating, they're breathing, they're journaling, they're doing all these things that we know from research and scientifically that it helps us to be more empathetic and effective and all of these things, and that the older generations just don't create as much space for as the younger generations. So So when these young Gen Zs that everybody wants to beat up right now become CEOs and on that journey up there, I hope that we will have less turmoil, hopefully, right? I mean, I hope we have less turmoil than we're seeing now.
That's a great point. And some of them are entering those leadership roles as we speak, and creating that next generation workplace. Might be interesting for business leaders to have conversations with some of these Gen Z folks about, you know, if you were sitting in my shoes today, what are the two or three things you would do to make this workplace a better place? Just, and without judgment, you don't know what's going to come out of their mouths, and not everything is going to be a gem. But right, to be able to ask that question. Chisa Miller, thank you so much once again for being a guest on Hold On, Let Me Close My Door. We always value your insights and your experience and just your genuinely caring way that you think about people and people in today's workplace. So thank you.
Thank you.
And to all of our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Hold On, Let Me Close My Door. Until next time.